Welcome to Voice of Mytilini. This episode's guest is Jetta, and she has joined us today to speak about Campfire, which was a self-organized search and rescue group active on Lesbos' south shore for several years. The average distance between the south coast of Lesbos and Turkey is at most 11 kilometers, and is therefore often used as a crossing point for migrants looking to get to Europe. Lesbos is well known for the struggles that migrants have to go through in order to find a decent new life. Recently, it has become more known for the deadly practice of pushbacks. As a result of these, the people are forced to hide upon arrival, without assistance or support. It wasn't always this way, and Campfire was one of the many groups active on Lesbos in order to ensure people's safe arrival. An interesting aspect about Campfire specifically is the fact that they were a self-organized rescue group, in contrast to the many other organizations that were active in this field on the island. So today, without further ado, we speak to Jetta and get her perspectives, opinions and experiences.
Well, I am Jetta. I was working in search and rescue at the shoreline of Lesbos from beginning of 2016 till the beginning of 2020. I live on Lesbos, and besides this, I have been involved in rescue missions also in the central Mediterranean, twice with Juventa, twice with Sea-Watch, and besides search and rescue, I'm working in general with migrants on Lesbos mainly, trying to support people as much as possible.
And what I've heard on Campfire, and also the reason I wanted to make this program, is that aside from the organizations that are more well known working on Lesbos on the shoreline, these are all somehow quite formally organized NGOs. And they do a lot of publicity, they do a lot of this kind of things. Well, if you Google Campfire, you will not find so much, as opposed to, you know, Lighthouse Relief or something. So this makes it quite an interesting topic, because I was wondering, why do you not find so much information on Campfire? I mean, these people were active for years. Like, what is the background in this? At some point, I started to figure out that Campfire is organized in a much different way, or was organized in a much different way than these other organizations. More self-organized. Could you explain to me, how do you get to this conclusion, and how this does being a self-organized rescue group actually work in this kind of situation?
Yeah, let me maybe start with the second part of your question, because this explains the first part. Self-organized, what does it mean? I mean, obviously, in each and every group, you will have people with more and with less experience. This does not necessarily have to create a hierarchy in terms of decision making in general, as a general question, like where to go with a project. It does, though, have an influence in the very moment of a rescue, for example. Yeah. So basically, the idea was, I mean, especially living on Lesbos, you see many, many big NGOs or you saw, because these times are over, but in the past you saw all those big NGOs with a lot of money, and the decisions how this money is spent is usually made in some back office in, let's say, the Netherlands or in Germany or in France or wherever, but not on the ground. And we felt that this is neither a structure that we like politically, nor a structure that will actually really help us doing our work. So what we did was kind of unique in a way, in terms of we had a core team here, but even from the core team, everybody was working also with other projects, and on top would do X amount of shifts throughout the week. And the shifts were night shifts only. We didn't monitor in the daytime. So, of course, this core team is not enough. You need quite a lot of people to cover shifts that basically, you know, people need to be there 8 hours every night. And in each team, you need at least 4 people. In the beginning, we were more, but then we adapted a bit to the needs and to the change in terms of people power on the island. You needed a team consisting of four people, and among them always one team lead, which again it sounds like hierarchy, but the main point is this is would have been the person with experience in order to make the ad hoc decisions. So due to the fact that nobody was working with Campfire full-time, people were here anyway. And this, again, meant that we neither had to provide accommodation nor any financial support. So no money at all was needed, to enable people to do this work, which, again, means we didn't have to ask for fundings. All we needed was kind of little money for equipment, for charging the work phones, and to put fuel in our cars. And this money we actually managed to find among ourselves. So everybody was just putting in 10 euro every now and then. And the costs that were about 600 euros per month, mainly for fuel, were covered with this. So we got around this whole thing of having a big back office structure or, also a big media presence was not needed. And this part is crucial to me, because what we have seen, what some of the others of the other NGOs were doing, was basically right in the moment of people arriving, they would take pictures, they would take videos. Believe me, this is not a moment where somebody would really appreciate a camera in his or her face. Yeah, and we always said we do not want to do this. So this is also why we had a zero media policy. Journalists were not welcome, and we ourselves were also never behaving like this. So nobody in Campfire ever took pictures of the arrivals. And this is also why you wouldn't find us in the internet, because there were simply no arguments to have a homepage. The only argument would have been to report what's going on. But then we felt like there is enough pictures of boats and people arriving on the shores of Lesbos. Why do we have to add on to this?
During the time that you were doing Campfire, did you give interviews?
Not really. I mean, there were one or two occasions where I would give an interview, but then, in a setup like now, like I would have been sitting somewhere, maybe even at the shore, but not during the night and not in a moment of actually active working. Because also, one thing is you can give an interview. A total different thing is to have somebody taking pictures or videos of an actual rescue operation.
So in the setup that you just described, where you're working with people that are anyway on the island, and this helps you a lot in terms of financial pressure, but these people then, I can assume for your story, were not professionals, because the other organizations, I would say most of them, or this is the impression that I have, would be working with professionals, or at least some.
Yeah, I mean, define professional, right? I would say the core team that I mentioned, they were mostly not trained lifeguards nor firefighters, like professional emergency responders, no. But they had gained a lot of experience on the ground and working with professionals. So they were trained to a level that I would say was as, if not even more professional than quite some of the other actors, just due to the fact that this core team mainly consisted of people that were on the island for ages and that had done this job already for years. So, through this, we managed to reach a level of being professional as a team that I would say we never felt we have to hide or, we are somehow less efficient or professional or less well-trained than others. Though, if it comes to people that join such a team and they only stay for X amount of time, let's say 4 weeks, which I believe was our minimum time back then, of course you have to train them. And this is what we did. We had a quite long briefing for everybody. So before doing your first shift with responsibilities, you would be with another more experienced person and you would receive a briefing of actually 8 hours. Plus, we had a practical, hands-on training once a week where you would really practice, how to welcome a boat in a safe manner on shore.
I mean, practically, professional, of course, to me also means that something else besides like practical knowledge or theoretical knowledge even, like for a doctor or a rescue swimmer or something, but also emotionally, I can imagine it must be quite difficult for people to be put in a position, I mean, from the images that you see and not the sensationalized, highly stylized photos of some organizations. I can imagine some really bad things happen also during an arrival, or can happen, and that this can take quite an emotional tax on the people involved. So how did you deal with that aspect?
I would say already before people would join, one of us would have had an interview with them and trying to see a little bit, you know, how stable is this person, what is actually the motivation to join. Because also, yeah, with this work potentially come quite intense and bad experience, but I think the main challenge always was boredom. Yeah, just to stand it if there is a week or 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks without a single boat arriving. And all you do is you're at the shore, you are patrolling, you are staring through your binoculars hour after hour in wind, in rain, and then to stay motivated for this time, even if nothing happens, is really, really crucial. And this was always a main part that we would have tried to already figure it out before and prepare people well. Then after every operation or whenever something happened, we would have a proper debriefing, first in the whole team, but then also the team lead of this night would approach the people again and say like, hey, would you like to talk about what happened? And sometimes it's not even a very heavy thing, like it's not necessary that somebody died or that almost died or something like this. It can be small things, you know, that there was like this one child on shore that reminded you your little baby sister. And this can be quite a shocking and heavy moment for people. In my opinion, the only way to deal with this well, and this doesn't matter if you're a professionally trained, let's say a firefighter or a paramedic, or if you are not and just there to, you know, to be on the lookout and to give some dry clothes and some rescue blankets to the people, it is the same. Like, you have to talk about this after with people who understand and who do not judge you in terms of like, hey, what are you talking about? What I have seen. Yeah, like this would have been, of course, the worst response. And there I think it's just important to create an atmosphere where people know that they can approach other people in the team, their team lead, whomever, or maybe the person who had the first interview with them or the person who trained them, in order to really speak about this these moments and to take everything that was experienced by volunteers, all their feelings, very, very serious.
What does a typical boat landing look like? Could you walk us through what that looks like for Campfire, let's say?
So for Campfire, we were in the position that the southern shore of Lesbos is actually quite gentle for arrivals. So there is in only few areas is big rocks. Yeah, mainly we're talking about beaches, not sandy beaches, but still like accessible beaches. So let's assume a boat would arrive there. In the best case scenario, what would have happened is that either our volunteers or volunteers from other organizations would spot the boat in a distance, possibly even still, let's say, 1.5 mile out. And then this person, whoever spotted the boat, would kind of communicate this with everybody else on scene. And then people would double check. And at one point it's confirmed, yes, it is a boat heading towards us. In this moment, already authorities would be informed. I guess why we might come back to this later. So authorities would be informed and we would get in position in order to wait. So because, you know, just because you see a boat heading towards you, it doesn't mean necessarily that it will arrive right in front of you. So you have to stay flexible. You already try to judge a little bit the condition of the boat, which you can understand a bit from the way it moves. So, for example, as long as a boat moves straight forward, most probably things are going well. As soon as it stops, we are possibly facing an emergency. Because as soon as a boat stops moving, it is really dangerous because the sea will just rock it in whatever way the waves go. But okay, let's say the boat is still moving towards us, so we would get ready. The boat most probably will kind of slide quite gently a bit towards the shore, but not actually on shore, because at one point also the engine would get stuck. So we would advise people in the boat to turn off the engine, and then we would enter the water, two people at least on each side of the boat, grab the boat, pull it in as much as possible, which is quite limited how much you can do it, and then we would stay in the water in order to stabilize the boat. There, it would be crucial to advise the people to stay inside the boat, not jump from the sides, because this can be really dangerous, not to give children from the side of the boat, but leave the boat in a very orderly manner, one by one from the front, and then wait on shore. So boat is empty, we would pull the boat on shore in order to just leave it there for the authorities to deal with it, and then we would go to the people and offer our support in terms of warm clothes, maybe just rescue blankets, if they are cold, water, of course. So the most basic things, and then, of course, a first rough medical checkup, like a triage, if there is any emergency case, and in case no doctor is around, we would call doctors on call in order to support us, and obviously also an ambulance. We would again inform the authorities that the boat had landed. Most probably they would have been already around, but if not, we would call them again, inform them that the people are with us now, give them the location and ask them to please come and pick them up.
And pick them up in that case means?
Come with a bus and bring them to a camp. Back in these days, it would have been Moria, in order to be registered. This is not something that we necessarily liked, that it is like this, but the people came or are coming in order to ask for asylum. In order to ask for asylum, they need to present themselves to the authorities. In order to be registered, they have to go to the camp. And the bus of the Coast Guard was, at least in the later years, the only option for them to do so.
Because, I mean, quite early on Lesbos, it also became criminalized to transport people.
Yeah.
Right? Like in your personal vehicle. So you couldn't have gotten your own bus and brought the people yourself. This was not an option.
Exactly. Like in the beginning, UNHCR was still picking up the people from the shore and bring them to the camp. So they had the permission to do so, but they stopped at one point, and then Coast Guard / police took over. But before, let's say in 2015, a lot of people arrived in the north of the island. And this is about 60 kilometers from there to the camp. And people were actually walking. And imagine small countryside roads full with people, children, luggage. And people had to walk 60 kilometers either in the very cold in winter or in the summer heat. And in this situation, of course, a lot of locals stopped and offered people a ride. Yeah, I mean, it's obvious if you see a family with, three kids and one of them a little baby or a highly pregnant woman or somebody injured or elderly people, this is just what you do. Already back then, people got sued for this.
Yeah. And wait, is this one of the things that was interesting and also inspired me to ask about this is, of course, the organizational structure of Campfire and the consequences of that. But I can imagine that you have to, at some point, you get in contact with other organizations, NGOs that are working, and also sometimes maybe you have to collaborate with them. If so, how did that play out? Like, in practice, but also maybe how you feel about it?
Well, it was not always easy. And in the very beginning, there were quite some actors that it was incredibly difficult to work with. Not because of our structure, but just in general. With the time, it becomes quite obvious for everybody involved that you need to at least coordinate. yeah, we went a bit further. We also were doing trainings with other groups and NGOs. And I still do believe that was the right thing to do, because in the end, it's not about who is the best team or, you know, who has the right approach. I mean, especially, you know, if it comes to sea rescue, I do not think that generally being a bigger NGO is something evil to do. Yeah, it just comes with certain things that we didn't want. And we were in a very special and very luxury, in a way, position that we could organize the way we did. But it was never that we said, like, we are not going to work with these evil big NGOs. No, not at all. Like, we were all working together at the same shore for the same purpose in the end. And I think in every team we're quite amazing people. That I enjoyed a lot working together with. So just because somebody is volunteering with a bigger NGO, it does not mean that this person is less of a great comrade or colleague in this situation.
But what about the other way around? Because, of course, your perspective or the perspective of Canberra is one thing to be like, hey, let's work together. But were there organizations... You don't have to name names, but like organizations that were reacting to this, like, who are you? What gives you the right? Like, do you have certificates? Something like this?
To be honest, not so much, because there were single individuals, including myself in Campfire, that were there already from the very beginning. And so people knew us and they would have trusted us. And then it all depends on behaving as professional as others or even more. Yeah, so after, you know, months and sometimes years working together, I don't think that anybody would have questioned the quality of our work as individuals. And then when these individuals tell you, okay, we are now a bit more of a proper team, nobody would really even ask how we are organized. Right, it's not written on our foreheads or our T-shirts. We just do what we do in a slightly different manner.
Campfire has been active, or was active, for some years. And what changed in the course of these years? Because when you started, I guess there was a different government in Greece in charge, and it's quite visible that the change in government in 2019 led to a whole paradigm shift in the migration struggle in general. What were the changes, like bigger, smaller, whatever you comes to mind?
I mean, already before the election of the new government, it became quite clear that we have to be really careful in order to not be criminalized. What does it mean, careful? Because we never did anything against the law, right? So how can you be more careful? But for example, we started to register all our volunteers at the ministry, even though that was by law not really required, but just in order, you know, to be able to present the police when they would check on us in the night these papers. We just decided to do so. So, for example, like in the beginning, the police were there anyway, right? Do not imagine we did something in the dark or in the shadows. It was like the cops were around all the time and we were communicating. And they would see us and they would know us. I mean, they still know my first name, huh? Which is maybe not something I like so much, but this was just the situation. But at one point, the Greek police, the Greek Coast Guard, the Port Police, Frontex, every authority you can name, would stop by in the night and check on us. Yeah, present me your driver's license, present me your passport, present me your NGO registration, saying we are not an NGO wouldn't actually have helped the situation. So this, you know, just happened. And this increased over the time more and more and more. But we were still able to operate. This changed after Neo Democracia came to power, and it changed dramatically. Also, Corona and the regulations played their role. So at one point, I mean, you know, people would even be banned to go out without a good reason, and doing shoreline response was not a good reason. But anyway, already before the situation turned more and more tense with the police checking, not only checking on us in the night, but actually taking us in, not arresting, but taking us in order to check our papers, which is ridiculous, of course. I mean, they took me at least 3 times in a row, always the same officers. I was like, officer, do you really think my passport changed till yesterday? And by the way, you just addressed me with my first name. So, it didn't make any sense. But it became clear, like, now something is happening. Like, something is really going on. And parallel, what happened was that this whole narrative of the migrants are not just annoying, which was already before the thing, no, this situation has to stop at one point, that's so difficult, and da-da-da. But it was from annoying to they are Erdogan's weapons, bullets, actually. Yeah, so kind of Turkey is pushing them towards us to destroy our country and our culture. Not only received like this in Greece, of course, to a bigger extent, considering the history between Greece and Turkey, but generally in Europe. Yeah, the whole reception of migrants, of the topic migration changed. And then actually at one point Greece decided that everybody who is arriving couldn't ask for asylum at a very specific moment and would be charged with illegal entry. So people were taken to the port and had to stay in an old military vessel, I mean accommodated there, for I don't even remember how long, without knowing what's going to happen next. Yeah, in the end, this procedure was dropped. But still, at this moment, it was clear if we receive people and if we inform the authorities about the arrival, it would mean we sent these people to jail. We collaborate with a system that criminalizes these people, that did nothing but entering Europe on an already dangerous way because they don't have any other, and that would completely violate their right to ask for asylum. So we couldn't already, continue working because of this. Parenthesis, in order to be able to work, as mentioned before, we had to inform the authorities to, you know, just be on the shore, receive boats, and then just, you know, leave and not inform the authorities at all wouldn't have worked. It would only have led to people sitting there not knowing where to go and us being arrested for sure. So not an option. And the second thing was that at this time the method of pushbacks got quite institutionalized. Pushback means that people who are already on, let's say, Greek territory, either waters or on land, are collected by the authorities and after dropped on life rafts or on seaworthy vessels or just dropped in Turkish waters. And this already happened in the past, yes, occasionally, but with the new government, this became a quite common procedure. It is the most common procedure, actually, until now. They are still denying it's happening, but still it is, and we already, you know, we got this information and we saw what's going on, so it was quite clear if we continue working the way we did, we will end up being complicit in these crimes against humanity.
Also, the first major COVID lockdown in Greece, end of March 2020, was preceded by quite a turbulent few months on Lesbos. Did this have any impact on the work Campfire was doing?
Yeah, well, masked men with baseball bats did not actually help the situation. But again, as a self-organized team, there is ways to self-organize. So I still do believe we would have been able to deal with the threat somehow. The other thing, though, the political aspect and very practical aspect of not collaborating with authorities that are torturing people, this played the way bigger role.
Can you talk about maybe some of the best and some of the worst experiences you had whilst working with Campfire?
Let me just a bit more general answer the question, really good aspect is you meet amazing people. Yeah, you work with amazing people, but also the people arriving, impressive people with impressive stories. And I always felt it's quite an honor to be the first person or one of the first persons who are able to welcome these people in Europe. One of the not so nice aspects is doing night shifts in really shitty weather, being, you know, already 1 hour after you start, like, frozen, and, you know, it's another 7 hours to go. But maybe on a bit more, like, you know, personal level, there is, like, one or two things that I for sure will never forget. I maybe start with a not so nice one. I mean, doing this work, of course, you also deal with suffering quite a bit. And I still remember one night in 2016, right after the EU-Turkey deal was implemented, or actually when it was implemented, obviously people in Turkey panicked. They were not, it was not clear what to expect. They thought maybe we are straight away returned to Turkey. So they tried desperately to arrive before the deal is actually implemented. So in this specific night, we had more than 35 boats on the southern shoreline only. I mean, only there were others in the north, but like in our area, it was 35 boats. Which was already very crazy, but almost all of those boats were extremely overcrowded. And due to this situation in this very night, two people died. They had a heart failure in the vessels because of too much pressure, because people were sitting too tight. And this obviously was a quite awful moment. But then, you know, also on a more daily basis, what is happening is, like, you know, you are welcoming people. You are trying your very best to be as welcoming, as friendly, as supportive as possible. And then, you know, they enter the bus and the bus will bring them to one of the shittiest imaginable camps. There the suffering really starts. And, OK, it is a decision to still do this job. But it was always incredibly hard for me to, you know, hand people over to a situation like this. I mean, it's not me handing them over, but it's the logical outcome of our actions, no? Still the decision was always, it is better to be there than not to be there. and then the really, maybe the nicest ones, you know, for example, one time a group arrived in a very, very shitty area where they had to walk quite a bit to reach a place where they can be picked up by bus, quite a rocky area, and the people were really tired. So we kind of tried to make them move, and I was like, come on, Lo, we have to go now, please, it's really important, otherwise you will get really cold. And out of the sudden, people started singing Bella Ciao, and I mean, I know it became quite a pop song, but it's still a song touching me. And we sang Bella song in five different languages all together, and this made us, you know, being able to move the, I don't know, 1.5 kilometers that we had to walk to the pickup point. That would be one. Another one was like a really old lady arriving alone. It was also in 2016. And she had nothing but nothing. Like, she was traveling alone, but also no luggage, nothing, nothing. And so I kind of started talking with her in order to make sure that she's okay. And at one point, she got some candy out of her pocket. And she offered me, and I said, like, how does it come? You have nothing, but you have candy. And she said, yeah, well, everything I had was stolen from me in Turkey. And, you know, my family, they already traveled first. I didn't want to, but now things became so bad in Syria, so I had to. But anyway, my family told me that people like you will be there. And, you know, I thought I cannot come empty-handed, so at least here's some candy. I mean, come on. Like, I still have this candy in my house, no? And, you know, there were just these, like, incredibly nice moments of interaction and some very touching. Others you would realize days later that this was intense. And so I still feel really privileged that I ended up being able to do this work.
In the end, after you stopped, or during, were there any negative consequences for you or other people in Campfire as a result of working in Campfire? Because we touched upon briefly, had the police come to check every night, and this sounds more or less routine, but were there any like more intense consequences?
Oh yeah, there were. Fortunately, in Campfire, nobody beside me. But if it comes to ERCI, this is a Greek NGO, and some other volunteers around, there is a court case against us, accusing us of facilitating illegal migration, being members or funding a criminal organization, espionage, which is still my favorite, money laundering, like crazy accusations, a total smear campaign. And actually these accusations back then resulted in every NGO leaving the shoreline beside us as a team. We stayed. The court was meant to happen. Well, it all started in 2018, yeah? But the court was meant to happen already last year. It got postponed. And now the upcoming court date is the 10th of January, where we will have to defend ourselves for rescuing people, while apparently investigations, if it comes to the pushbacks and actually killing people, do not even take place.
Okay.
So, yeah, looking back at the time, of course, there is mixed feelings, right? Like, I mean, to start with, it was always sad that it was private people like us who had to do this. It was never something that we wanted. Basically, one of the main demands always was like that state actors, that authorities fulfilled their duty to rescue to a sustainable degree. As this didn't happen, we kind of tried to fill the gap, which I believe we did well. So, you know, on the one hand, I'm of course proud and happy of what we did and also of how we did it. Because first of all, we could assist thousands of people. We can, of course, only assume, but most likely we were able to prevent severe damage or even death in a lot of cases. I'm still very convinced of the way we did it, like a horizontal way of organizing, zero media policy. So we, you know, never felt forced in order to get big fundings to take pictures of people right in the moment of arrival, and like all these things that the big NGOs have to do in order to be sustainable in the NGO business. We managed to find our ways in a very activist way around all this, and this is still something I'm proud of, and I believe we did right. Then, you know, right now, sitting here at this place where I spent hours and days and months of my life, of course I'm sad that this kind of work right now is simply not possible anymore, that we had to stop, because as difficult as it was, again, I think we did the right thing. And also, it was a work that I liked doing. I think we managed to reach an amazing level of being professional with a team only consisting of volunteers. And we did a great job. And it's really sad that this is for political reasons and for the oppression that is happening not possible anymore. I mean, I wish we would have a situation where we wouldn't need to do it. But now we have a situation where we would still be needed, but we simply cannot. And this leads to people suffering and dying on the shores and in the sea.